and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, retired Army Major General and University of Alaska President Emeritus Mark Hamilton. Hamilton's talk, called He Who Holds Alaska, looks at the role of Alaska in American strategy and defense policy. This talk was jointly hosted by the Cook Inlet Historical Society and the University of Alaska Anchorage Honors College. It was recorded October 16th at the Anchorage Museum. Judy Bittner of the Cook Inlet Historical Society introduces Mark Hamilton. Here she is now.
My name is Judy Bittner. I'm a board member of the Cook Inlet Historical Society. Jim Barnett, our president, who usually does our introductions, is out of country. So I'll be stepping in for him today, as well as Bruce Parham will be helping when we get to our question and answer time period. I'm going to welcome you to the second Cook Inlet Historical Society lecture in the 2014-15 lecture series, which is dedicated to the Anchorage Centennial. The first three lectures of this series are devoted to the Cold War. In the 2015, the lectures will focus on exhibits that we'll be showing at the Anchorage Museum. They include the an update on the revising and updating the Alaska Gallery, the Cook Inlet exhibit, and the Baseball in Alaska exhibit as well. If you are a member of Cook Inlet Historical Society, I want to thank you for your support. And if you're not a member, I urge you to join. There is a membership form on our brochure, and out there in the lobby is a brochure with our 2014-15 lecture series. So I hope to see you back here the third Thursday of every month between now and May, except for, I think, December. Tonight, please join me in welcoming Major General Mark Hamilton, U.S. Army retired, and President Emeritus of the University of Alaska. He was President of the University of Alaska for 12 years, from 1998 to 2010. This Alaska Day lecture is jointly sponsored by the Cook Inlet Historical Society and the University of Alaska's Honors Program. General Hamilton served two tours in Alaska, one in 1988-90, and a second tour in 1992-1993. He's going to provide his insights into the military strategic actions during the Cold War, especially the role of the Nike Hercules missiles and engagement of civilians in Alaska. Please give a warm welcome to General Hamilton.
Well, I've been fascinated to meet some of the folks out there in the lobby. A little discouraging to find out that there are many people sitting here who know a whole lot more about the history of Alaska during the Cold War than I do. But perhaps you'll take some joy in sharing my enthusiasm for looking into this, really for the very first time, studying the Cold War and in Alaska. So I'm about encyclopedia, Wikipedia smart on this thing, where we have other people who have actually served on Nike Hercules batteries. So SE will take all those questions. I've already checked with him. I warned him, so it's only fair. And I did warn him. I'll just pass those on. As I was stumbling through looking at some of the history, I did find one fascinating thing that I'm going to give you first that doesn't have anything to do with the Nike Hercules things. And this had to do with the enlistment, the recruitment of stay-behind agents. Fearing a Russian invasion and occupation of Alaska, the government in the early Cold War said, we need to get some people who can monitor movement. They thought that what would happen is you'd get a bombing raid of some sort, probably in Fairbanks, Nome, and Anchorage, and that they would land troops, although they feared those would probably come on the Kenai Peninsula. So they wanted to find people who could report on the movement to be, in essence, an underground agency. J. Edgar Hoover was deeply involved in this and later passed it on to a protege by the name of Joseph Carroll, who ran OSI out of the Air Force. They met with some outstanding people in the state, fish and game, some people in the court system, and said, who are these people? I mean, who are the people that we can trust to do this? And they found 89 of them, and they did a couple of things. One is they taught them what ended up being an abject failure, and you can understand it as I explain it. They gave them a 15-hour course in codifying, making codes and sending codes. 15 hours did not produce the kind of success, and actually it has a cute little anecdote because of that. But they took these individuals, they paid them 3,000, there were 89 of them. They didn't mention to the 89 that they had also recruited people in the lower 48 to replace the casualties. So you can see why they would have kept that secret. They did, however, cross their palms with silver. They gave them $3,000, which would have been about $30,000 today as a retainer, and told them if the war actually started, they would raise that to $6,000. So they did, in fact, enlist these folks. We know very little about it because even after this very, very highly classified program was finally released by the government, which was probably about 2000 through 2005, probably a 50-year hiatus when they could let these things actually come out. They had redacted all of the names of these individuals. So we know only one individual that it was a bush pilot who ended up dying because of a plane crash. So we did know his name, but the rest of them are just gone. It was called a washtub, was the secret name of this particular organization. And the historian who wrote this was quick to point out that washtub was not really a washout. It lasted from 1951 to 1959. And that's a really good long time. Obviously, the war did not come. But washtub was not just an act of paranoia or of desperation. They really thought the Russians were coming. And if you kind of look, and again, with your knowledge and your interest in history, you're very well aware of this, but at this stage of the game, let's look what's happening. 1950, you have a Soviet-backed North Korea invading the South. You have NATO being formed. We thought Korea was a distraction to cover plans to move in Europe. So at the time we're having the Korean War, we're over here forming NATO. The year this was founded was the first year that the Russians exploded an atomic weapon. And this is the time when Mao Zedong's communist-led group took over China. So there's a feeling here that it's hard for us to grasp and we look at this thing and say, oh my gosh, this was kind of a crazy scheme. But in fact, it wasn't just a crazy scheme. There were very real reasons to believe that the Russians were coming. This is the time, you remember, where literally, and there are some of us in this room old enough to recall, where we had drills in grammar school. I mean, where you're crawling under your desk and avoiding looking at windows so that the atomic weapons wouldn't blind you. And every school child was aware of this and knew what to do. It was the days when people were building bomb shelters, not like the ones on reality TV today, but lots of regular, normal people really believed that this thing could happen. I will say that the attempts to teach people coding in 15 hours kind of backfired. In 1954, there was a typewritten letter that was misaddressed, and it came to somebody in Anchorage who turned it over to authorities, and the FBI went absolutely, according to their internal memos and everything, went absolutely crazy because they thought, oh my God, here it is. What it was one of the 89 stay-behind agents was practicing his code and produced something which was coded, although not decipherable by even the people who made up the code. So apparently the training was not sufficient. I found that just fascinating. Didn't realize they had such kind of thing. They built caches for them with lots and lots of food and communications, coding gear, radios and the like. And the person who wrote it noted that even though it didn't come to be utilized, in fact, the caches were served the kind of local population for a very long time. People finally said, okay, the war isn't going to happen, and here's all this, what do you think, spam, whatever it was they had in there. It would still be good, by the way, if they had it today. Spam doesn't run. You do know that SPAM is an acronym. Did you know that? Spiced Pork, Austin, Minnesota. I spent some of my life in Austin, Minnesota at the Hormel plant, and they made SPAM. But that's the way the Army had it written out. Spiced Pork, Austin, Minnesota. I actually like it. We are the second largest consumer of SPAM per capita in the United States. You know who's first? Hawaii? Gosh, you guys know everything. Okay, let me try the talk about the nuclear shield for Alaska. When you look at the map, as Billy Mitchell did, and you recognize the power of flying over the pole, it doesn't matter where you go. We're the shortest distance between anything. One of the things worked in the Alaskan Command. I was the chief of staff for Joe Ralston when he was out there. And one of the things that fascinated people from the lower 48, and believe me, people aren't whining when they say they just don't understand. The strategic, what Billy Mitchell said, the person who owns, he understood air power. And he understood the pathway through the air that comes from flying over the poles. And he said that the person who owns Alaska owns the most strategic point on the globe. When we would tell people in the lower 48 that we could deploy people from Alaska to Europe faster than they could from Fort Bragg, North Carolina, their jaws would just drop. Just never considered that would be the case. It so happens that same strategic location existed during the Cold War. So if the Soviets were going to bomb the lower 48, they had no choice but to come over Alaska, because the other route obviously would expose them longer, take unbelievable amounts of fuel to be able to fly to the places that they obviously had targeted in the lower 48. So the first thing they did is they built a series, a significant series of Nike Ajax missiles. And they stationed these around. There were like 12 batteries around New York. Stationed them around Strategic Air Command. Stationed them around their KC-135 refueling aircraft. So they protected, just it was area protection of some of our most precious assets. It was only upon the advent of the Nike Hercules missile that they were able to address the obvious strategic route that the Soviets would have to go through. The Ajax missile couldn't possibly have affected much what we believe to be a massive group of bombers. They didn't have the kinds of, well, you didn't have GPS, you didn't have the kinds of remarkable controls we have today that can literally direct every single bomb to a special, specific location, reprogrammable, on the move, totally different technologies. Then what happened was you just lined up a bunch of bombers, and you've seen enough World War II footage to realize what we're talking about. Well, when you start bringing in a massive formation, all armed with nuclear weapons, and you know where they're going to fly, you've got to do something about it. And what we did about it was we put the Nike Hercules missiles. Nike Hercules missiles were a very significant weapon. They had armed with as much as 40 kiloton nuclear warhead. Now, to give you some perspective, that's more than three times the size of the Hiroshima bomb on every single missile, although they did go from 20 to 40, so you had your choices, I guess, depending on how big the pack was out there. The idea was to fire these things very high in the air and blow them up above the formation. Obviously, there would be a significant amount of damage. The other piece of it is, in all atomic weapons of that kind at that day, is the radiation would make the weapon systems inoperable. Wouldn't make them blow up. It would just make them inoperable. So they'd now be carrying a bunch of dummy rounds. This was a heck of a missile system. I mean, we're talking about the 1950s. This thing could spot an aircraft at 100 miles. The missile could launch in 2 minutes, go up to 150,000 feet, armed, as I said, with these remarkable capability of the nuclear weapon. It went about Mach 3.5, so faster than any jet we've ever admitted. It's pretty quick to get up there. Ultimately, they deployed about 145 sites throughout the United States in the kind of 50s and early 60s. We had nine of them here, at five up at Fairbanks and four in Anchorage. And you can talk about the locations of those. I'll mention them quickly, but as I say, SE actually knows these things and served up there. You had at Fort near Fort Wainwright, surrounding that Nielsen Air Force Base, you had five sites, Tear, Peter, Jig, and Mike, and another one called Site Love. Site Love was the farthest one north and pretty well had the mission of being the first one to engage. Now, during this time, the Soviet Union would test Alaska. They'd launch from Russia and do like zigzag patterns across, and we, of course, would send up our interceptors. This went on for a very, very long time. I was General Ralston's chief of staff at 92, and we had them then. We had Russian bombers fly at Alaska and went up and intercepted them, and they take pictures of them and the like. But back in the day when they did this, the Hercules sites would track our interceptors because they were always very iffy on fuel if they followed the bomber long enough. And so we would track them all the way back to home base so that in case any one of them went down, there would be the possibility of relatively quick reaction, knowing exactly where they went down. Unlike the lower 48, where this was all controlled by, and it had a different acronym there, but it's essentially NORAD, was essentially the kind of command and control headquarters. In Alaska, the weapons were completely controlled by the head Alaskan military command. Pretty significant burden when you start to think about the responsibility of it and the enormous number. I mean, remember, we're talking about nine of these sites. We're talking about 14 missiles per site. And, Essie, I don't know if that is just a general number, if they had somewhat less than that. Each of them armed with 20 to 40 kiloton weapons. You're talking about a remarkable amount of nuclear capability resting in the hands of some poor general who found himself assigned to be the head of the Alaskan Command. That's quite a mission. The sites were very, very well defended against invasion, much less defended against observation. Talking about double barbed wire, razor links on the top, guard dogs led by military personnel within the two, imagine just two lines of chain wire with the little loop of razor wire on top. And in between is a guard and a dog. The guard is armed, and the guard has permission to use deadly force. Now, what's fascinating, of course, is these things were unbelievably easy to see because of our tremendous climate scenario here. They had to build a clamshell over the top of the radars. So you've probably even seen pictures of them. And maybe if you prowled in the woods 25 years ago, you could have actually seen the clamshell still there. Well, you could drive up and look at it. I mean, as long as you didn't go through the wire, I mean, there were roads leading to these things. You could actually drive up, take a peek at it, even though this is what happens in the military. They constantly would get alerts. Okay, here comes a Russian satellite overhead. Get all your weapons hidden. Well, of course, they knew precisely where we were because everything's all hidden away, and there's the clamshell. Well, we were targeted with about 250 megatons of nuclear weapon from the Russian side. They knew they had to destroy the Nike Hercules sites in order to have their bombers come through. So they had targeted with 250 megatons. So we would have been glowing by the time they got through, that's for sure. You're very familiar with Site Summit. That was probably the most remarkable of the stations because where it was, terrain it was on, chopped down half a mountain, put it in there with reinforced concrete and the like, and took quite a bit of time and quite a bit of money to build that. One of the things that's kind of fascinating, here we are with five sites up there around what we now call Fort Wainwright. It at that time was called Ladd Air Force Base. This is less than a decade after that same site, Ladd Air Force Base, was used in the Lend-Lease program. So we used to have our planes land there and take off for Russia, and now we surrounded it with nuclear weapons to make sure that the Russians didn't return the flight. So we sold them a one-way ticket in that particular case. Now, the way these things were organized is you had firing batteries. It had about 100 people in it. It had a headquarters unit, and it had the operational units of the deployed missiles. They would have a kind of hot battery and then a cold battery kind of thing, and it had to do with how long it would take for them to become operational. So lots of training. Missiles are out, deployed, reaction drills and the like. Remember, it takes about 2 minutes when you're standing there. During the entire period of the Cuban Missile Crisis, everybody on deck was deployed for 5 minute notice. They did that for more than 30 days. That had to be some tired soldiers by the time that thing got done. Now, the reward for being vigilant and the reward for taking on this remarkable mission probably destroyed more careers than we will ever know. Believe me, I was in charge of a artillery unit that had nuclear capability, and I have stood by and taken tests year after year, sometimes month after month, that probe your capability to, one, build it. I mean, it doesn't come, this isn't like a 30-06 shell. Where you just pick it up and do it. You actually build the nuclear weapon. And you have to demonstrate that you can build it, transport it, take it apart. The margin for error is almost nothing. I mean, literally, you could be building the weapon and have some great young soldier drop a wrench on it. And it's over. You fail. When these things come from the Department of Defense, because you have the Department of Defense, you have the Army, you have your division, you have your brigade headquarters, all of them give you these tests. And it's a time of very, very fitful nights as you wait to see your career destroyed by a mistake. We used to have an organization in the Army that was the called Pershing. And the rumor was in Pershing, you could make it to battery or to battalion command if you'd only been relieved twice. That's how significant it is. And the Department of Defense one is one that will make you take deep breaths, because the first step is to hand them the envelopes to your next higher headquarters, next higher headquarters, to the Department of Defense that says, I want to inform you that I've just failed a nuclear readiness inspection and must be taken from the list of nuclear capable units. And so step one is you hand them to the inspector. And if everything goes well, they hand them back. But it's really quite a nerve-wracking experience. So when I listen to people, talk to people who have been involved in these nuclear inspections, I always do so with a sense of real admiration for that individual, because they have been through some of the most tense moments and exercises that you could ever imagine. All of this works the way you see it on TV. Two-man control, so no one person can ever be the person who launches this thing by themselves. I mean, it always exists in every nuclear program. You go to two separate safes with two separate combinations, take out two separate halves of the code, and together you can put together the delivery parameters, where one person could never do it under any circumstances. So from hot battery at 15 minutes down to everybody on deck for 5 minutes, you have kind of the pace, the metabolism of the Nike Hercules effort. They never fired. Never got an opportunity. They did test shots to demonstrate they could get the missile off the ground, mostly at the site battery, at the summit site. People would wait for it. Everybody was aware of it. Had the big star. Had that for a long time. I saw the star. I understand, actually, in the business of rebuilding that as an historical site, and I think they should, just as a tribute to those folks. Toward the end, when people still were, see what happened is you suddenly get ICBMs enter the equation. Now we can do intercontinental ballistic missiles. We don't have to do the bomber formations. Technology is increasing, and slowly but surely, the capabilities of the Nike Hercules weapon, as marvelous as they were, especially for that age, became overcome by the offensive capability. But they still feared some potential ground invasion of Alaska, and so they actually retaught the Nike Hercules folks how to shoot from ground to ground, which probably didn't take a lot of change. They knew what their missiles did, send in a location and pretend the airplane's flying at, 17 feet and got it. Never got to fire those either. So they have an expression that they've used that says they also serve who only watch and wait and are prepared to defend. Mission accomplished.
You're listening to Addressing Alaskans with retired Army Major General and University of Alaska President Emeritus Mark Hamilton. His talk, called He Who Holds Alaska, was recorded October 16th at the Anchorage Museum. It was jointly hosted by the Cook Inlet Historical Society and the University of Alaska Anchorage Honors College. From here, the talk moves into a question and answer period with the audience.
So with Essie's help, I'll take any questions you might have. I really am about Wikipedia deep on this, so I'm going to point and hope that other folks can fill me in.
I was intrigued by your bringing up the stay behind agents.
Yeah.
When I worked for the National Park Service, I was doing an aviation study in the Wrangell-St. Elias Park region, and Nabesna Airstrip was one of the areas that I was looking at. And of course, that strip was for the mine at Nabesna, and it was used by the bush pilots who flew mining supplies in and the ore out. And it became important to the Lend-Lease effort because it helped fly in supplies for the Northway strip, which is kind of neat. And I was doing a little bit of research, and thanks to folks like John Klo here, I was able to come across some of the, probably the same documents that you had looked at too. And it was really interesting because archaeologists doing a site visit out to the Nemesda mine found a mine shaft that hadn't been built by the mine. And it wasn't that secret either, because there was a big sign on it that said Department of... So this is the federal government properties. Yeah. Keep out. So I don't know how covert it was. But they surmised that it probably was one of those cache sites. And I was, that made me curious, and I started doing a little research on who possibly was one of the stay-behind agents. And, of course, it was all speculative, but I, after doing some census reports, I figured it was probably the watchman who had a pretty good view of the road coming in on the Mesna. And, of course, the Russians knew about these sites, and so the worry was on defend the Lend-Lease sites that probably weren't that necessary after the war, but certainly was a point of where the Russians knew. So I just thought that was really fascinating. It's a neat story.
Yeah, it's a shame that they, and I understand why they did it, but the FBI redacted all the names, so the only one we ever knew was the guy who died. I guess they figured if he died, they didn't even redact his name. So it's the only one we know, because it's feasible that some are still alive. They'd be in their 80s, but they very feasible. Yeah.
I was in Galena, I think it's in the 80s, and I'd never been there before. And I was shocked at this huge airstrip. And it looked like the black planes that look like bats, are the stealth, aren't they? Is that what they are? Evidently, that was a base that I guess probably when the Russian pilots were testing our borders, then we would fly those planes. Do you know anything about the Galena airstrip?
I've never heard anybody say that. We had two fighters on alert there 24 hours a day. Yeah.
Okay. Was there more than the Galena? I mean, there were other.
There were others. Yeah. Too? Clear was also a place. Anybody else got King Salmon? Yeah. Oh, it was real. I mean, it was real even in '92. And then finally, as you know, things got. We remember the big decisions about can we bring them back. And then we put them on a, we'll visit every once in a while kind of a thing. And then finally, I think, expenses just ultimately caused that to have to pull back. And, of course, the fact that the Russians weren't sending over nearly as many. It was always a surprise. But we always knew and we always intercepted.
Can you offer a present-day overview of what they're doing with missile sites in Alaska?
Okay, give me that one more time.
I'm sorry. Can you offer a present-day overview of what they're doing with missile sites now in Alaska?
Well, right now what we've got is the missile site that will attack the ICBMs. They're going to double the number of missiles that are there. This was all built primarily by Boeing. And actually, a classmate of mine from West Point put them in. He was out of the Army then, working for Boeing. These are absolute. They're almost science fiction. kind of missiles. These things, if you can imagine an intercontinental ballistic missile traveling Mach 3, and this thing goes up and hits it. It doesn't explode. It literally hits the missile. At those speeds, it disintegrates everything in the missile. It doesn't hit it. It hits it with a thing that, what does it look like? It must be something we know. About the size of an air conditioner. Got little jets all over it. You could hold it in your hand. I mean, it doesn't, or you could hold it in two hands. All it has to do is just maneuver its way around until it gets right there and makes contact with the missile. And just at those speeds, it's the kind of theory that says a cyclone can drive a straw through a telephone pole. Just this massive force disintegrates the whole thing. It's almost impossible to imagine that, you know, this is like hitting a bee with a BB at 1,000 yards. Just remarkable. So you can't do it on accident. People always go, oh, we had a failed test. Yeah, you've had some failed tests. But they've fixed that. It really had to do with how long it took the computer to refire a positioning jet. And even though it was microseconds, they had to make it faster in order to do that, because in this case, a miss is as good as a mile. I mean, if they don't hit it, got nothing. They don't blow it up or anything. So these things are very, very powerful. And, you know, it's just kind of a revisit to what we knew before. They're not going to fire a missile, have it go here, and then take a left at San Francisco. It's going to come right over the top. And we're back in the business of protecting America with a, in this case, an anti-ballistic missile system.
When you talked about the 89 who were prepared to be left behind, what about the public? Was there any evacuation plan?
Actually, there was. There was... primarily the evacuation of combatants, but it was part of this entire deal. They wouldn't just give enemy movement, but they would also arrange for pickups of indigenous people who had been moved by the war. Because the Soviet Union at that time had an expressed military policy of, in essence, destroying any resistance. So any kind of forces who were offering resistance at all, which would probably be most Alaskans, it seems to me. I mean, they had to try to find a way to get them out, and these guys were in charge of that planning. You know, how are you going to pick them up? Where are you going to send them to? What are the rallying points and this sort of thing? Yes, same people. Same people.
Did any U-2 or and or Blackbirds
there was
be
a,
located in Alaska, flew in
yes,
and out of here?
We had a lot of U-2s. Again, they wouldn't even tell the Air Force base that they were coming, but citizens could watch them fly in and take off again. Yeah. So the U-2s did fly out of here. Another remarkable aircraft that, until Gary Powers got caught up, was able to fly essentially with impunity because nobody could reach it. Nobody had a missile that could reach the U-2. Similar thing happened with the Blackbird. Imagine this is 1950s technology. They built a Blackbird that flew so high and so fast that when they filled it with fuel, it leaked. It just all started to leak out because they needed to allow for expansion at the heights that they were flying it at. So they couldn't seal it. It would end up getting crushed. You know, it's like, you ever drink half a bottle of water on an airplane? You put it back, and by the time you land, it crunches up like this. Well, it had the same problem. 1950s technology, which built this Nike Hercules. Think about this. They have one of the blackbirds in the Air Museum in Washington, D.C., out near Dulles. When the plane was delivered to Dulles Airport, I'm going to make this up, 6-7 years ago, something like that, the flight it took set the speed record for a transcontinental flight. 1950s technology. Yep. So we were doing something really good back then.
I had a question myself. Sure. When I was a child growing up in the early 50s, we were always told, you know, to hide under our desk, you know, in case there was an attack and that sort of thing. But I recall there was only about 15 minutes of warning time when Soviet bombers would leave their bases and get over America's heartland. Was that about right, or was it just sort of to Alaska, and then it took another 30 minutes or so for them to actually, you know, take out New York City or Chicago or another large city?
Well, no, it's going to be a lot longer than that. Now, whether or not we could actually identify the path and identify the particular target, I mean, it's going to take as long as it takes a commercial jetliner. It's going to take a long time. I mean, it's going to take long enough that they have to come over Alaska, because if they tried to divert, they'd use too much fuel and they couldn't get there, I mean, in the 50s. But, yeah, you're talking about airplanes that are going to fly at 350 knots max, and probably less to conserve fuel if they ever had hoped to come back. So we would have known they were coming, but think about the technology then. Nobody's going to tweet you and say, here they come.
Well, with, I mean, ICBM missiles, it would take what?
Oh, just a lot. Now you're talking about a lot shorter period of time. You're probably talking about something like 20. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're moving in that thing.
Well, I've got one more. Friends of Nike Site Summit, our official policy when we're giving tours and talking is that Nike Hercules missiles were nuclear capable, but we can neither confirm nor deny that they were nuclear weapons here. Of course, we know the answer to that, but we're still kind of restricted in what we can say. So it's real interesting to hear you say, oh, yeah.
Well, I'm going to tell you that from my perspective, I mean, I don't know whether the OSI will come in here and get me later, but...
we were told that was a possibility.
These were...
just last winter.
The entire operational employment included the setting off of a nuclear weapon. So you kind of have to have it with you. Now, what happens, you know, these things survived the earthquake perfectly fine. As a matter of fact, Essie was talking to me just a little bit about this. and I reiterate, you don't have a nuclear weapon sitting there because some of these things were disturbed during the earthquake. Okay? The pieces could fall down there, but until it is assembled, it's not a nuclear weapon. It is a nuclear capable weapon. You have to make the warhead. And in this particular case, none of them were, there's just no danger.
Yes, thank you. I was in Canada at that time, and we didn't learn to crawl under desks. So, but I guess my question was a follow-up to what this gentleman said about the warning or how much time there was. And wasn't that the purpose of the dew line sites, the distance early warning sites, to provide another half hour to 2 hours, depending on whether it was a missile or whether it was jets coming over the pole, to have those all across the north so that there would be an alert, not for Alaska particularly, but for the lower 48, for the rest of the continent.
Absolutely correct. So once again, we see Alaska's strategic location being part of a military strategy. Initially with here they come to here they come and I can see them and I'm going to blow them up. And now with a new generation of here come the missiles and I can see them and I can blow them up. But they have to come over us, and I think that just speaks to the long-term viability of the military significance of the state of Alaska.
I was just wondering how long it would take to construct one of these warheads, just out of curiosity.
How long it would take to...
like, build one of the warheads?
Essie, can... Long time. A long time. You know, on the only unit that I was in... No, I mean, I'm talking about putting together the parts. It would take, in my experience, in having a nuclear capability and artillery weapon, it would take us something like an hour to put it together. Something like an hour.
Is the current use of Alaska as a strategic location still geared towards Russia primarily, or are there other countries that were...
Well, of course, now we're getting other players in the game. You certainly have the potential of a North Korea. We're about the only place they can reach, maybe Hawaii. Ultimately, anything that flies is going to have to come over us. Just that simple. And is it Soviet Union? Probably not. You know, we had 27,000 nuclear weapons on each side at the heights of the Cold War. 27,000 weapons each. Agreed to cut that back so you didn't have, triple mutual assured destruction, quadruple mutual assured destruction. But the fear of those missiles and the numbers of them were kept so that people would say, if you do this thing first, who's going to be the winner? Because we're going to, as our last act, we will press all the buttons and now we're both dead. And it's fascinating. That seems like a very, very poor excuse for reason, except it has established 70 years of contentious, but in terms of World War kinds of concepts, peaceful coexistence. Nobody wanted to do it, basically. Essie has a question. This could be really bad.
I'll keep it quick. Nike Hercules was replaced by Patriot, and I'm very prejudiced in the fact that I still believe Nike Hercules, even today, would be a superior weapon, and if they had upgraded the electronics. Patriots have won for just short-range battlefield
right.
against the Scuds.
Right.
Back then, if you... The reason to get rid of it was, well, it's one missile, one aircraft. That was BS, as you pointed out. One missile, 300 aircraft. Bye-bye, 300 aircraft yeah. with just one Nike.
Sure.
And our... The saying back at when I was a TAC director, Roger Madonna, which we were Madonna, which was the Army Air Defense Command post, we have one Mike 2230 to intercept.
Yeah.
So it tells you exactly what we had.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, there's a different weapon system for a different threat, clearly. I mean, Scuds are going to be launched very typically in ones or twos, not 300 aircraft, and... you get to engage them without setting off a nuclear weapon, which is pretty good about Patriot. And Patriot 2 is an excellent weapon system. I'll tell you, it was a fantastic weapon system, and this typically happens. Air defense weaponry very often ends up being a trading chit. If you think about it, remember, the success of mutual assured destruction is I can destroy you, but I'm going to get destroyed, okay? So look what happened when Reagan wanted to put up the, what do they call it? Oh, Star Wars, yeah, okay. I don't remember the real name of it, but that was the press name, and it stuck. It ended up being a trading chip. You don't do that, we'll do this. The Pershing II missile ended up being a trading chip. Basically, we demonstrated to the Soviets that this missile system would make every underground headquarters they had totally vulnerable. Okay, so they buried them deep enough that the hit-miss distance of a typical ICBM, they'd survive. Pershing can fly through a window, your window that you picked, that window right there, boom. And that kind of accuracy with the nuclear weapon made all of their... So what happened was, we said, you pull back your 17 divisions from the Fulda Gap, and we will let you supervise the dismantling of the Pershing II. Many of our weapons, our defense weapons systems, have been trading jets, because all of a sudden the whole logic of mutual assured destruction goes away. I can destroy you, and you can't destroy me. Everybody goes, whoa, you know, different equation, and people move. Of course, what you have to do is demonstrate it. You have to bring over their scientists, bring over their military and political leadership and say, look, here's what it is. Here's what it can do. And once they've analyzed it and said, oh my goodness, they're right, it can do that, all of a sudden things start to happen that might not have happened otherwise.
Well, thank you very much. It's been quite fascinating. Let's give a warm hand.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with retired Army Major General and University of Alaska President Emeritus Mark Hamilton. His talk, called He Who Holds Alaska, was recorded October 16th at the Anchorage Museum. It was jointly hosted by the Cook Inlet Historical Society and the University of Alaska Anchorage Honors College. This talk is a part of an ongoing lecture series focused on the Anchorage Centennial. For more information on future talks, including talks about the Cold War, you can find a link to the Cook Inlet Historical Society on our website at alaskapublic.org. Scroll down and look for Addressing Alaskans on the right. Thanks for tuning in with us today. I'm your host and producer, Monica Goki.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.